To understand God's grace is to be freed to show grace to others. To understand God's grace is to be freed to show grace to others. Now, last week I talked about Abigail a little bit, and Abigail is obviously in the middle of the story of King David, and today's story is going to be about kind of around King David again. So I thought it'd be fun to talk about the five most famous stories related to King David. And maybe you have your favorite, and I have my favorite, but kind of the five of the stories that really put David on the map. And of course, we got to begin with David and Goliath. Because in that story, what we see is when Israel, and really King Saul and all of Israel, only saw the big muscles and the big mouth, David saw a great opportunity for God to again show how amazing he is. And so he went out, grabbed the stones from the brook, and he went out and he put those stones in the sling and around and around and around and around. Remember that song? Anybody sing that song in Sunday school? And around and around and hit the giant in the head and... All right, who didn't grow up in a Baptist church? Come on. Hit the giant in the head and the giant... Thank you. Some of you guys are saved here, so that's good. Man. I'm up here singing a solo. Goodness, I'm suddenly all sweaty at something. All right, so that's the story, right? And that's really the first big story when it comes to King David. It's kind of what put him on the map. From there, his fame begins to accelerate. Well, the second story is similar in a lot of ways. If you remember when the story of David actually begins, it starts off in his house, in his family's house. David was just a shepherd boy. Samuel the prophet decides that God actually tells him to go to the house of Jesse and find the next king of Israel. And so he goes to Jesse's house, and Jesse lines up what I like to call all of his favorite sons. There's only one son missing who's the youngest, and who would want the youngest? He's out shepherding, he's out in the field, right? And so if you remember the story, Samuel comes in and all the boys are there and he takes a look at the first boy and he's big and he's strong and he's handsome. And Samuel says, surely this is the next king of Israel. And God says, man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart, right? So I always find it ironic that poor David didn't even make the draft line. But in he came fresh out of the field. And he is anointed king right in front of his brothers. It's like every little brother's dream. You know, do you think that David from time to time, you know, his brothers are picking on him after the story, and he's like, I'm going to be king someday, and I'm going to get you back. That's what every little brother would say. That's story number two. Story number three. We can't leave out the fact that even though David was called a man after God's own heart, he was far from perfect. And in this next story that we all know very well, we see the imperfection of David. And as the story goes, in the spring when the armies went off to war, David stayed back. And he spied a beautiful woman named Bathsheba. Yeah. Which set off a series of events that shows us that no matter, it doesn't matter if you have a heart of a champion for the Lord, you are still weak enough to fall. Well, Bathsheba was married. David took care of that. And he soon married Bathsheba, the now pregnant Bathsheba. And the Lord was very displeased with all that he did. And he struck the child dead for the sin of David. It's a fascinating story about sin and consequences. Story number four is perhaps a little less famous than some of the others, but it's one of my favorites. The first part before David becomes officially king, if you remember from the story last week with Abigail, he was hiding for his life, and he was kind of the outlaw, and he would hide in caves, and he was always trying to outfox King Saul, who was after him. But no matter how good you are at outfoxing everybody, eventually you're going to get caught. Eventually foxes get caught. And in this part of the story, David and his men are in the back of the cave when King Saul decides to use that same cave to, let's just say, use the facilities. Because facilities are always found in caves. and so, as the story goes, Saul comes in, He's literally squatting right in front of David, if you can imagine that story in the Bible. David has only to stab him through and kill him to become the next king of Israel. And he creeps up, and you expect David is going to do it. And instead of killing Saul, the anointed of God, he cuts off the corner of his robe and then kind of melts back into the shadows. And he becomes so convicted that he did that, that just a few verses later, he calls out to Saul and he repents of what he did. And Saul realizes that, why am I chasing this guy? He's a good guy. He realizes that he was that close to being killed. But because of the guy, the man, the character of David, he was not. Story number five, as it relates to our story today, David is famous for lots of things, but one of the things that he's famous for is his friendship with Jonathan. And they became, the Bible says, they became as brothers. Jonathan was the oldest son of King Saul. He was the prince, and David was the outlaw. It's like the stuff of every good story, right? Well, in the part of the story that I love is Jonathan realizes that King Saul, his dad, is going to try to kill David. And so David and Jonathan put together this little scheme of how Jonathan is going to relate the news, don't come to the feast, dad's trying to kill you, to David. So they go out in the field, if you remember, and he shoots arrows and he sends the servant boy, no, the arrows are beyond you, and that's the signal word, and David is over hiding, and David realizes, my life's in danger, Saul's going to try to kill me. And the funny part of that story to me always is right after they shoot the arrows and the servant boy goes away, then Jonathan and David sit and talk for a while, which, why didn't they just do that from the beginning? I mean, you read that story and you're like, that doesn't make any sense to me. But it's all part of the friendship and Jonathan trying to protect his best friend, David. And that friendship between the prince and the outlaw, between, if you think about it, the rightful heir to the throne of Israel and the anointed heir to the throne of Israel, it's been the stuff of legends for 3,000 years. And there's other stories about David. And you maybe have your favorites, whether it's the armies or the mighty men or the battles or the wives or whatever it is. But there's no character in the Bible that dominates more of the Old Testament than does the story of King David, especially when he put together the Psalms, most of which he wrote. David is kind of the main character throughout the narrative of the Old Testament. And the question that we always come back to when we think about David is why did God call David a man after his own heart, God's own heart? He certainly wasn't perfect. He did a lot of things wrong along the way, but he did a lot of things right. And it's been an ongoing question as people have tried to figure out, what is it about David that so impressed God? Because if we could figure out what it was in David's heart and in his character and how he interacted with people and the decisions that he made that God found so impressive, then maybe you and I could find that same thing and work on those same things in our own lives. But why? Why was David just impressive to God? And there's several times that we read of this phrase, a man after God's own heart. Let me show you two of them. I have before you up here, 1 Samuel 13:14 says, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. This is Samuel talking to King Saul. And the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. And so several times in the Old Testament, we find this phrase, a man after God's own heart, but it's also reiterated in the New Testament. And when he had removed him, he raised up David to be their king, of whom he testified, I have found in David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart who will do my will. So the Lord had, there was something in David that the Lord looked at and saw as impressive. But it wasn't his perfection, and it wasn't that he always did the right things, but there was something in his actions. And today I think we'll get a little bit of a clue about what was so special about David that he got God's attention. And we got a lot of reading to do. So 1 Samuel chapter 15 is where we're going to start the story. 1 Samuel 15. And we're going to skip around to all kinds of different passages, so you'll have to keep your fingers kind of nimble. 1 Samuel chapter 15. And so this is where the story of David begins, even though he's not really named here. 1 Samuel chapter 15. Here's what it says, verse 22, chapter 15, verse 22. It says, and Samuel said, Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. So this is Samuel talking to Saul. And let me paint the picture of what is going on, and let's try to back up before we can fast forward through the story. And let's back up all the way to Egypt. Remember, when the children of Israel, when the Israelites left Egypt, they followed Moses, their 40 years of wandering, but they had no king because God was their king. They get into the promised land. They conquer the promised land. Things are good. There's a whole book of Judges. They have men and women that watch over the people, but still God is their king. But when we come to 1 Samuel, the people of Israel looking around at all the other nations, they're looking at all of the kingdoms, and everyone has an earthly king, and they begin to demand that God gives them an earthly king, which was allowed by the law, but it was essentially a rejection of God as the king of Israel. And so they rejected God, and God said, okay, I'll find you a king. And he found the man Saul. If you remember those first parts of the story, remember the day he was supposed to be anointed, he was hiding in the luggage, hardly a good start to the inauguration of your kingdom. But Saul was, in a lot of ways, everything they expected from a king, and the kind of dictator attitude that comes along with that position. And as you look at 1 Samuel 1, kind of all the way through about 15, God sticks with Saul. He follows him into battle, and in a lot of ways, Saul does some good things and some bad things, and God sticks with him until 1 Samuel chapter 15. And in 1 Samuel chapter 15, Saul essentially violates and sins against God, but does it openly in front of all the people for all to see. And that was the moment that God said, I'm ripping the kingdom from you, and I'm giving it to a man after my own heart. So the book of 1 Samuel then is this transition from a theocracy, God is king, to a monarchy where Saul is now the ruler and the beginning of Saul's dynasty. As you go throughout the rest of the book of 1 Samuel, it's all about Saul and David, and Saul's trying to find David, and David's kind of outfoxing him and in and out of the caves and running around, all this craziness. But when the book of 1 Samuel ends, it ends with the death of Saul and his oldest son named Jonathan. So 1 Samuel ends with the death of Saul. 2 Samuel begins with the rise of King David and the anointing of King David as king. So years go by, peace is established. This is 2 Samuel going forward. Peace is established, the nation prospers. God gives David wealth, he gives David children. He's arguably at this point in history perhaps the most powerful man in all of the world, probably the wealthiest as well. So everything is going great. The kingdom is good. The kingdom is established. There's power. There's wealth. There's commerce, trade, and ships, and everything that anybody could ever dream of. God heaped blessings on King David in an unprecedented way. And so we come to our part of the story today, and it was just a normal day for King David. Commerce is coming in, he's making decisions as kings do, building palaces, his children are around him. It was just a normal day. And in that normal day, for reasons that we don't know, he began to think about his best friend, Jonathan. And if you've ever lost somebody that you love that is very close to you, there are just days that you think about that person. There are sights and there's smells and there's words and memories, and all of a sudden you start thinking about that person. And evidently this day, David began to think about Jonathan, and he missed his best friend. And on this day, he remembered something very, very important a covenant that he made with Jonathan. And I want to show that to you in 1 Samuel 20. So flip over to 1 Samuel 20. I'm going to show you this covenant that Jonathan and David made together. 1 Samuel 20, verse 42. It says, Then Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, because we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever." And he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. They formed this covenant that essentially says this: for the rest of our lives, if I die, you're taking care of my kids. If you die, I'll take care of your kids. And I remember well, when we left for the mission field, I remember working on my will. And I remember working on my power of attorney. And I'm sure many of you have those kinds of documents. And you got to think about, if I die, what do I want to have happen? That was this story for them, where David and Jonathan become kind of godfathers to each other's kids. And they covenant together that we're going to take care of your family no matter what happens for the rest of our lives. It's a serious commitment, a serious covenant together. So now we'll get to our real story in 2 Samuel 9. Because in 2 Samuel 9, David is remembering Jonathan, and he's remembering this covenant, and he's thinking about his friend, his best friend that he misses, and he remembers this, "I will take care of your offspring forever." And in 2 Samuel chapter 9, we pick up the story, and we finally come to our character. Here's what it says, 2 Samuel chapter 9. It says, "And David said, is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" In other words, I made this covenant with Jonathan, and all of a sudden I remember, oh my word, I'm supposed to be taking care of Jonathan's kids. That's the covenant I made with my friend. Verse 2. "Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba," which means striped one. Just thought I'd throw that one out. "And they called him to David." Thank you. Matt's the only one laughing over here. That's fine. I pay him to do that. And the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show kindness of God to him?" That's the question. Is there still someone? Is there an offspring? Is there a distant relative of Saul and of Jonathan then? And then Ziba, the servant, says, "Yes, there is one. There is," verse 3, "there is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." So David suddenly realizes that I made this covenant with Jonathan all these years ago, and now there is a son of Jonathan that's still alive. This is my chance to make good on the promise that I made to my best friend. And we learned that Mephibosheth, this guy, there is this one son of Jonathan that is still alive. But there's a problem. He's crippled in both of his feet. Now, when you think of a prince, because certainly this was a prince of Israel, you don't think of a guy who is crippled in both of his feet. And so maybe you wonder, how did this guy become crippled this way? Well, flip back to chapter 4, and we get one verse summary of how this all happened. 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 4. Here is the one sentence that tells us how Mephibosheth became a cripple. It says, "Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame. His name was Mephibosheth." And you think, well, how does something like this happen? How does the nanny do this? Well, let me tell you what was going on. Back then, when there was a change in the kingdom, when one king died and a new king's successor was coming up, it was very common practice for that new king to kill all threats to the throne. It could be an uncle, a distant cousin, but especially children. So at the end of 1 Samuel, when Saul and Jonathan die and the news reaches the palace, what happens is the whole place goes into chaos. They got to protect the kids. Everybody that's a distant relative, they're all fleeing for their lives. It is complete chaos. And so this nanny guy, this nanny woman here, who has the charge over Mephibosheth, one of the princes of Israel, scoops up the boy, scoops up some belongings to flee to save his life. And somehow in the chaos of the palace, and maybe people are running around and she's trying to run down the stairs, we don't know, and somehow in the chaos, the boy falls. Maybe she drops him. Maybe she gets run into. We don't know, but he falls. And somehow in his fall, in his injury, he becomes crippled. And we don't know to what extent, if it was just his feet. We don't know if it was, you know, from the neck down. We don't know any of that. We just know that he fell and he became a cripple. And his name was Mephibosheth. And in this, we see the beginning of this story. Because his name was Mephibosheth, which means shameful. Shameful. He is Mr. Shameful. Shameful because he's a cripple in a culture where the handicapped were thrown off to the side. He was shameful because he represented the fall of the dynasty of Saul, the last living relative of the family. And he was shameful, as we're about to see, because of where he was living, just how far the family of Saul had fallen. He was Mr. Shameful. Go back to chapter 9. Let's continue on with the story here. So now we know that there's one son of Jonathan. His name is Mephibosheth. He's crippled. Let's continue on with the story. Verse 4. Chapter 9, verse 4. The king said to him, that's Ziba, this striped servant, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lodabar. Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lodabar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. So where he was living at Lodabar tells us a little bit about just how far the family of Saul had fallen. Lodabar is a city that literally means nowhere. He was living in nowhere. I mean, if you can find Lodabar on a map, it's at the end of an old dusty road. It's the place where people went to hide. There was no commerce. There was no main road. There was nothing in Lodabar. It's where you went if you had nowhere else to go. And several times throughout the Old Testament, Lodabar is actually made fun of as the place of like the end of the old dusty road. It's the end of nowhere. Nobody wants to live in Lodabar. And that is where the last living relative of Saul, the only son of Jonathan, was living. That is how far the family had fallen. So in this part of the story, the palace guards, they fetch Mephibosheth. He's living in Lodabar at the end of the last road out of town. There's actual evidence that Mephibosheth changed his name as he went into hiding because he knew if he was ever found out that it would be the end of his life. So he goes and he lives in Lodabar as far away from the palace as he could get. And he had to because if the king's men showed up, it would be the end. Now imagine how his days went. He's a cripple living in a dusty old town in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by other people that are all trying to hide. It's a quiet town. There's no movement. There's no money. And that's where he lived. And every day he would watch out the window and he would look and he'd wonder if this was the day that the soldiers would come. And he watched down that dusty road to see if dust clouds would be rising, if horses would be coming. And every day he was afraid that today would be the day. And when we come to this part of the story, it was the day. And you can almost imagine that Mephibosheth was there and it was just like any other day. And he sees the cloud of dust rising in the distance. Horses are coming. And his heart begins to pick up the pace just a little bit. And as he sees those horses come closer and he realizes there's armor, there's spears, there's swords, he sees the banner of the king and he realizes these are the king's soldiers. But maybe they're coming for a different reason. Maybe he can still hide. Maybe he can still get away. Maybe he's not why they were there. Until they knock on his door and they say, Mephibosheth, the king wants a word. We know at this point of the story that Mephibosheth was married. We know that he also had kids. And you almost can begin to feel the soldiers as they take Mephibosheth out, literally carrying the crippled man out to the horse or the wagon. His wife is crying. His kids are crying. They know what this all means. They know that if he's ever found out, it's going to be the end of his life. And there goes dad off to his execution. And they cry and they say, no, don't take him. And the soldiers aren't afraid. It's not like Mephibosheth is going to run away. They put him on the horse. They take him from Lodabar all the way to the palace, probably the first time he's been in the palace since the day, 5 years old, that he ran out with the nanny. And off the soldiers go with Mephibosheth. They take him to King David. And the text says, and it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, the text says that he bowed before the king, but what else would a crippled man do? And so there he lays on the palace floor before the throne of King David, maybe the same throne that his own dad sat on so many years before. And there he lays in the dust with his head down, knowing that it was his end. And in that palace, inside the court there, you almost can feel the soldiers are there and the bodyguards, they're watching, they know what's going to come. The court is there, maybe the queens are there, and everybody knows what's about to happen. And here's this crippled man on the ground, the last living relative of the previous dynasty. He knows, everybody knows, and maybe they smile, maybe they want it, maybe they can't wait. And King David certainly, he's killed many a man, so they know what's going to happen. They know the sword's about to come, and Mephibosheth knows it as well. And it's in moments like this very moment, in the court intrigue, when it's like everybody's taking a deep breath because they know it's about to happen, Mephibosheth on the ground, maybe he's crying, he's waiting for the sword to fall. It's in that moment right there that we see the heart of David and why it impresses the Lord. Let's continue on with the story. Still in chapter 9, verse 6, second part of verse 6. And David said, Mephibosheth. And of course he answered, behold, I am your servant. And David said to him, do not fear. Now those are three really good words to start with. To the man on his face before the throne, crying probably, everybody thinking it's going to be the end. Mephibosheth knowing it's going to be the end. And David says, do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. And then he says, I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father. Remember that king? Yeah. And you shall eat at my table always. And he paid homage, that's Mephibosheth, and said, what is your servant that you would show regard for a dead dog such as I? Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, all that belonged to Saul and to his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may eat, may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants, and Ziba said to the king, according to all the Lord the king has commands his servant, so will your servant do. So Mephibosheth ate at the king's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servant. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. So we get to the story, and as Mephibosheth waits for the axe to fall, panting, crying, wondering, maybe he's pleading for his life, and David says, do not fear. And what's so interesting here, and in the English we don't get it, he says, he doesn't just say, I'm going to show you kindness. He says, I'm going to show you chesed, which is covenant love, covenant kindness. It's translated sometimes as loyalty or loyal love, loyal covenant love, faithfulness. It's actually translated in one place as glory. I'm going to show you hesed. I'm going to show you this covenant love. This covenant that I made with Jonathan now applies to you. And I'm going to show that to you for the rest of my life and the rest of your life. And then he says, okay, I'm going to take all the king's land. Now, when King Saul was still king, he was a rich guy. He had a lot of land. I'm going to take all of that land that's now been parceled out to other people, and I'm going to give it back to you. And so instantly, you got to think in your mind, this guy, this cripple, he's on the ground, he's in the dust, and he's probably crying, thinking it's going to be the end of his life. He just got dragged in from Lodabar, the end of the road, the dusty old place where people go to hide, and there he is before the king. He thinks it's going to be the end, and the king says, I'm giving you all the land. In an instant, he goes from among the poorest in all of Israel to arguably the richest man in all of Israel except the king. That quickly. And he gives them servants. He gives them income. He gives them a future. And you can almost feel Mephibosheth going, am I hearing this right? This can't be. This isn't what people do to the previous family's dynasty. Why would you show this kind of hesed to me, of all people? And not only am I part of the previous dynasty, but I'm a crippled. I'm a handicapped guy. Why me of all people, he says. And then David, I think how this happened, but I think David smiles. And he says, oh, it just gets a little bit better. Not only am I giving you land, not only am I giving you income, not only am I giving you a future, but you from this point on will eat at my table. You, Mephibosheth, I declare from this point on, you are as one of my own sons. That is hesed. That is this covenant love, this loyal, faithful love. In this word, this covenant love that David and Jonathan now extends on to Mephibosheth. And in a final way, in verse 13, I love it. Just it's kind of like this anticlimactic. And so Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he always ate at the king's table. You know, there was no greater honor in ancient times than to eat with the king. And every day for the rest of Mephibosheth's life, he ate with the king. I love that. Max Lucado said, God answers the mess of life with one word, grace. That is the story. It is the story of grace. And if there's one thing that should mark us as Christians, perhaps more than anything else, it's our ability to show grace. Grace defines who we are. And in a lot of ways, people can disagree with us on a lot of issues, and they can say, well, you know, we don't believe the Bible is true, we don't believe all this religion stuff. But one thing they should never be able to say about us is that those people don't show grace, because grace is what defines who we are. And sometimes we talk about grace as unmerited favor, but I want to suggest a kind of a different definition for you to consider today. Grace is kindness shown to someone who does not deserve it, cannot earn it, and could never repay it back. Grace is kindness shown to someone who does not deserve it, cannot earn it, and could never repay it. This is the story of Mephibosheth. He did nothing in the story. In fact, if you read the story, he's almost passive in the story. He's just kind of a background figure. Everything happens to him. He's not active, really, in any of the story. He does nothing. And he's tossed from his home. He's tossed at the feet of the king, only to rise with dignity and honor and wealth and a name. Remember what his name meant? Shameful. As you look at his life up until this very moment of chapter 9, it was a shameful life. And all of a sudden, King David comes along and he gives him, in a sense, a new name. He removes his shame from him and gives him dignity instead. That's grace. He didn't deserve it. He was hiding for his life. He was part of the previous dynasty. He should have been killed by all rights. He couldn't earn it. He was hiding in the dusty old Lodabar in the middle of nowhere. And he could never repay it, because what do you give back to the king that has everything? That's grace. This is a story about amazing grace. And I think the beauty of this story is that it foreshadows exactly what happens to those who come to Christ. We come with nothing to offer. We come crippled. We come lame. And we have been found out. And we think it's the end. And we know it's the end. And we feel our shame. And we deserve nothing from him. And it's, and his first words to us are these: fear not. Don't be afraid. It's all true. You don't deserve this. It's all true that there's shame. It's all true. You're not earning any of this. Don't be afraid. And literally what we find is that Jesus says to us, I am going to show you hesed, covenant kindness, covenant love. I am bringing you into this covenant that you don't deserve, this covenant that you can't earn, this covenant that you're never going to repay. I am bringing you into this. And I declare from this point on that you are one of my own sons, and you will forever eat at my table. Yeah, you had shame, but I'm giving you a name. Yeah, you lost it all, and it should be the end, but I'm giving you everything. You lost the palace, I'm giving you the kingdom. This is our story. Mephibosheth is our story. It's exactly what Jesus gives to us. And I think if you can remember the moment that you came to Jesus, was it not similar to Mephibosheth on the ground, on the palace floor before the throne? Who am I that you would look and see and care about a dead dog like me? That's the moment we come to Christ. So why would he take notice of us? And I think the answer is that God's grace shines brightest to those who feel they deserve it the least. God's grace shines brightest to those who know, man, I can never earn it. I can never repay it. And I think what happens over time, when we let the reality of the grace of God truly get its talons into our souls, what it does is it frees us to give that same grace to other people. Because we realize we don't deserve it. We can't earn it. We can't hoard it for ourselves. So we can then be free to show grace to other people who don't deserve it, other people who can't earn it, other people that can't pay it back. But we can still show them grace. And I think when you feel the weight of your own sin, there's something in the grace of God that just makes you want to show grace to other people. And so you come to this question then, why does Jesus do this for us? Why would he show hesed to people like us, of all people? And if you've ever looked in the mirror, or if you've ever walked away from a sermon or a concert or some spiritual high, and you're like, why me? Why me, Lord? Why show this kind of grace to me? I think we get that answer at the end of the story of Mephibosheth, chapter 19. At this point of the story, David's son Absalom rebels. He tries to take the kingdom. David flees the palace, flees Jerusalem, because this coup is going on. And when we come to chapter 19, David is set to ride back into Jerusalem. But as he's riding back in, there's intrigue that has been going on, including Ziba, the same servant, spreading lies about Mephibosheth. But look what happens. Verse 24, chapter 19, verse 24. So 2 Samuel 19, verse 24. And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. Now just think about this along the way. So he goes out to meet the king. The king's riding back into Jerusalem. Mephibosheth goes out to meet the king. How hard is it for the crippled man Mephibosheth to get to the gate to meet the king? Keep going. He had neither taken care of his feet, he had long toenails, nor trimmed his beard, it was all scraggly. He didn't wash his clothes, he smelled bad. From the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. And when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king said, "Why didn't you go out with me?" David's kind of ticked, Mephibosheth. "Why didn't you go out with me?" And we have this kind of long answer. Let's run through it real quick. He answered, "My lord, my servant deceived me, for your servant said to him, 'I'll saddle the donkey for myself that I may ride on and go out with the king.' But your servant is lame." In other words, I couldn't go. I wanted to go. I couldn't go. Verse 27, "He has slandered your servant to my lord, but my lord the king is like an angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death before my lord the king. But you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then to cry to the king?" And the king had already made his decision. This is David. "Why speak any more of your affairs? I've decided you and Ziba shall divide the land." Now this is the big point. Verse 30. Mephibosheth said to the king, "Oh, let him take it all, since my lord the king has come home safely." So here's what's going on. David rides back into town. The first one to meet him is Mephibosheth, unshaven, unkept. He's so worried about David's safety. And David, because of these lies of the servant, has already decided he's going to take away half of Mephibosheth's land. And Mephibosheth has received so much grace from King David that he says this. He says, he can have it all. He can have all the land, all the wealth, all the fortune, all the future, all the income. He can have it all as long as I get the king. He can have all the wealth, my future. I'll take it all away. He can have it all as long as I get the king. Somewhere along the way, Mephibosheth came to love the king as the benefactor, but not for his benefits. So one of the reasons I think that God shows grace and he pours out this grace is so that we become people who love the grace giver, not just the benefits we get from the king. And I think there are so many people that they do the religious thing and they come to church and they go through all of the motions because they want all the benefits that come along with being a Christian. But I think those that delve the deepest and feel the weight of their undeservedness the deepest before God are those who realize along the way that they can love Jesus for Jesus. And even if we lost all of the benefits, still give me Jesus and I've got everything. That's this story. And I love that. I love that we can love Jesus for who he is. We can love him for what he's done. We can love him as the grace giver. And we don't stand, or in a sense, fall before him feeling entitled. You know, we don't have to treat him like the genie in a bottle, which, if we're honest, a lot of our prayers are like the genie in the bottle. Let's rub the bottle and let's ask for all the things that we need. But somewhere along the way, those who feel his grace at the deepest level, they come to love the king. I want us to be people who love the king, who treasured Jesus above everything else, including the benefits we get from Jesus. And I think when we really see Jesus as our great treasure, it's only then that we are really free to show that kind of grace to other people. Mephibosheth's story is our story. It's a story of grace.